The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, it looks like most people are settled now. So I would like to actually very briefly introduce the man who's doing introductions for our keynote speaker. Professor Herman Schwartz from American University is a widely respected leader in the international human rights and domestic disability civil rights fields. And I owe a particular debt to him that I have been looking for an occasion to fully explain for quite some time. It was Herman who took a risk many, many years ago, 14 years ago, when I first got a $25,000 fellowship to start a kind of crazy idea organization, Mental Disability Rights International, to look at the application of international human rights law toward people with mental disabilities. And Herman, who had apparently been thinking about the same thing for many years before, welcomed me to American University, opened up his offices, provided the resources of this law school, and my work and the work of Mental Disability Rights International would never have happened if he had not been willing to take a risk on a recent law school graduate with very few resources, but a big idea and one that he very much shared. So Herman will be introducing our keynote speaker, REA Nair, and REA and the Open Society Institute have been MDRI's largest and most consistent supporters, apart from the fact that they are now expanding to do much more work in the mental disability rights and disability rights fields. Again, we owe everything we do to their support. So without further ado, Professor Herman Schwartz.
Thanks, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here because it involves so many things and so many people who have been close to my heart for a long time. It really didn't take very much of a risk to go with Eric. He's an impossible person. He talked at me. I had known him when he was at the Mental Health Law Project as a student, I think. And this one, it's very easy to sell high-quality goods. And you see before you all the things that have happened in the 14 years that, as I said, it isn't much of a risk. This is especially pleasurable for me because it involves the two things that have meant a great deal to me. First has been the incredible performance of this non-risky enterprise that got its home here initially. Before this audience, I don't have to tell you about how much MDRI has done from its very earliest years in Hungary with psychiatric facilities, in Mexico where people were freezing in these places where it worked with the government, up to recently where it was so instrumental in ending electroshock treatment in Turkey and in exposing the fact that the orphanages in Romania are not quite taken care of as people have thought. You'll hear more about that later. And of course, what MDRI has done so well is not only to do these exceptionally fine investigations and reports, but to alert the world to them. And with a keen sense of where it is that you have to go in order to get your message through, MDRI, as you know, has had its what it's done reported in the New York Times, on television. It has worked with Congress to get money so that USAID programs are involved with people with disabilities. And in general, it has become a major force in the world, outside the United States. And now, I think I'm, from what Eric told me a while ago, beginning to move into the United States, as well as trying to expand its efforts in Latin America and to move into Asia. But as I said, you know all that. Or if you didn't before, you may know it now. The other aspect is this opportunity to introduce my old friend and somebody I have admired pretty much since I knew him. This was also one of these cases where, although I wasn't asked to take any risks, those who might have been didn't have to worry. I've worked with Arye Nair for now, it's just about 40 years, when Arye was head of the New York Civil Liberties Union. He very quickly went from there to the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, there aren't very many people here who will remember those days, but at that time, the ACLU was a good, solid organization. He turned into the powerhouse, the most influential force for human rights in America today. And it was he who did it back in the 70s, sponsoring programs like the Women's Rights Project, which was then headed by the woman who became Justice Ginsburg, who I think for a while was also general counsel at the ACLU, worked on supported prison projects, supported juvenile projects, civil rights projects, and pioneered in the area of people with disabilities, with mental disabilities, working with a brilliant lawyer who unhappily is no longer with us, Bruce Ennis. Arye and the ACLU and Bruce developed the right to treatment for people in mental institutions and brought lawsuits all over the country, which were landmark suits. Arye moved on to international affairs in the 70s, I think it was, and 80s, moved over to Human Rights Watch and America's Watch, where he almost immediately became an immensely powerful and significant figure. I remember when he and I were in Cuba together in the 80s, people just flocked around him, the dissidents, as somebody to whom they could turn in a very, very difficult situation. And then after he turned Human Rights Watch into perhaps, I think, at least I think so, the premier human rights organization in the world, he moved on to OSI, the Open Society. Now, for a good many years, Arye and I, as Eric said, had been talking about trying to develop something in the area of mental disabilities on an international basis, but we couldn't find anybody who really could do this. We talked to the people at the Mental Health Law Project, now the Basel and Law Center, which Arye was instrumental in setting up. But we couldn't get very far because they were obviously preoccupied with domestic matters. And then Eric came along. And I think within about 2 or 3 months, I asked Eric to come up with me to New York. I brought him into Arye's office. I remember this very distinctly. I had other things to do with the office at the time, and I said, Arye, I don't want to be involved with this at all. Here's the guy we've been looking for. Talk to him. And I walked out of the office, and the rest is history. So it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome Arye to the school and to invite him up.
Thank you very much. I think my principal qualification for being here is that I haven't been as deeply involved as many of you have been in this work, but I've been involved perhaps longer than anyone else here, with the possible exception of Herman. Herman mentioned a lawyer named Bruce Ennis, and my own major contribution to this field is that in 1967, as director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, that is 40 years ago, I was trying to establish a project to deal with the rights of those who were considered or who were labeled as mentally disabled. And the lawyer who I found to direct that project was Bruce Ennis. He was probably as able a litigator as I ever knew in my life. He subsequently became the national legal director of the ACLU, and he's also one of the finest persons I ever knew. And Bruce pioneered in litigating civil liberties cases for the mentally ill or those labeled as mentally ill, and then subsequently also on behalf of the developmentally disabled. Working with Bruce during that period, there were immense satisfactions. There were also disappointments. I think a disappointment was that we found that although we were often able to secure liberty on behalf of the mentally ill, and that was immensely important, we were not able to do so in circumstances in which significant social services were provided to them outside institutions. And because of that, a significant number of the persons who were released from the giant mental hospitals that we dealt with ended up as part of the homeless population, and I'm very sorry to say that a significant number of those in prisons and jails in the United States today are people who would have previously been incarcerated in institutions for the mentally ill. And so it was important to free them and from the mental hospitals, but it also would have been important, and we failed at this, to try to secure services for them outside institutions. On the other hand, I thought that the effort on behalf of the developmentally disabled was really one of the great successes that I have been associated with. When we became active on the issue of the developmentally disabled, I think there were about 150,000 persons in the United States in the large institutions where the developmentally or many developmentally disabled were confined. I think the number today is under 40,000. On the other hand, at that time, there were about 20,000 persons in the United States in small group homes. Today, the number is more than 250,000. And while there are deficiencies often in the small group homes, they cannot be compared with those giant institutions for the developmentally disabled. The degree to which they live as human beings, interacting with others, the extent of their liberty, the extent to which they enjoy personal privacy, the extent to which they are able to interact with their families is simply not to be compared with what went on previously. The institution with which I was principally engaged was Willowbrook, an institution on Staten Island in New York, which when I first dealt with it had about 6,000 inmates, and inmate is the only term that I could use to describe that institution. And I recall one person I met in Willowbrook. At the time that I met him, he was a man in his 40s, and because the attendants at the institution considered that he could not clean himself, he was hosed down periodically. He was thought not to be able to dress himself and not to be able to feed himself. As a consequence of the litigation that we engaged in, I saw him about 3 years later in an institution in the Bronx in New York, which was a kind of a halfway house between Willowbrook and a small group home. The director of that institution in the Bronx, in a sense, made the best out of an architectural mistake. The institution was housed in a spectacular building designed by one of the world's great architects, Richard Meyer, and Meyer got it all wrong. He had the building inward-looking, whereas what one wanted to do with the developmentally disabled is get them out into the world. It was a piece of extraordinary contemporary architecture, but it had very peculiar features. One of them was that the different rooms of the building had oval windows at the floor level. And I can remember asking Richard Meyer, why did he put the windows at the floor level? And he said when he had gone to an institution for the developmentally disabled, he saw them lying on the floor. And so he wanted them to be able to look out the window. And so he put windows on the floor. And I asked him, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to help them sit up in chairs and stand up and not lie on the floor? But that wasn't what he had seen, and so he designed the building for what he thought was the appropriate way to make arrangements. But the man who ran the institution, a Dr. Herbert Cohen, did some very simple things which seemed to me to help overcome a lot of the difficulties. One of the things he did was to organize the building into apartments. And as we came to an apartment to visit the persons living there, he knocked at the door. And he didn't enter until someone opened the door for him. The very idea that the developmentally disabled should have such privacy that they could determine whether somebody came in the door and that you simply didn't barge in was something inconceivable in the previous circumstances. At that point, the man I had seen in his 40s was certainly feeding himself, certainly dressing himself. He was taking showers. I saw him again about 3 years after that, living in a group home. And at that point, he had a job. He was employed wrapping packages. And the gap between being hosed down in that giant institution and being able to work, being able to an extent support himself, living with a few other men in that group apartment was all the difference in the world. And the satisfaction of seeing the effort to protect the rights of the developmentally disabled lead to that transition in a person's life seemed to me something tremendously significant. I think that the UN Convention gives us an opportunity to try to promote changes of that sort internationally. It will be very difficult, but this is the best opportunity there has been to deal with these issues. And I'm afraid that there are many places around the world where the conditions that I saw in Willowbrook 40 years ago continue to prevail today. It won't be easy because I think that in many places there won't be a possibility of engaging in litigation effectively to secure implementation of the convention. There are some places where I think that will be possible. But the foremost mechanism that the international human rights movement uses in order to promote the issues with which it's concerned is monitoring. And the essential element or the essential elements of monitoring is that there should be agreed upon standards. And once you have agreed upon standards, then you can say, look, there's a discrepancy between your practices and the standards that you have agreed to. And by pointing out those discrepancies, you get officials to move in the direction of the standards which they have agreed to uphold. And if they don't move in that direction, then you create embarrassment by pointing out those discrepancies publicly. That's the method. That's the main method. It's not the only method, but it's the main method by which the entire international system of protection of human rights works. And it's what makes international agreements about human rights meaningful. It's that ability to cause embarrassment by pointing out those discrepancies between standards or pretenses of government and the actual practices of government. In the case of the Disability Convention, at least in the mental disability field, which is the one where I've had some engagement, there are so many significant things that one can find. Commitment to community residence, to inclusive education, to legal capacity, to privacy. These are simple things in a way, but extraordinarily significant. They have not been rights which the mentally disabled, the developmentally disabled, have been able to claim. And by serving as monitors of the way in which those rights are actually dealt with in practice, I think it is possible to move in the direction of the commitments or the provisions of the convention. What matters in international human rights often is the degree to which the advocates take seriously the various commitments. To take just one example, the Helsinki Accords of 1975 are very weak as international law. They're not a treaty. They're not a body of law that was ratified by various governments. What made them important is that human rights activists took them seriously and monitored the compliance by their own governments with those provisions. And in the process of taking those provisions of the Helsinki Accords seriously, they actually became much more significant than many treaties that are considered to be binding international law. Our Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was once the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He served in that position under Gerald Ford. And if you read his autobiography, he talks about the way in which Ford was criticized for going to Helsinki and signing the Helsinki Accords. He was giving away a great deal to the Soviet Union, according to the critics, because the Helsinki Accords recognized the boundaries that emerged from World War II. And then Gates goes on to say, who knew at the time that the human rights provisions of the Helsinki Accords would turn out to be far more significant than anything else that the government of the United States had ever done in helping to bring down the Soviet system. But that was because human rights activists took seriously those provisions, monitored compliance with them, and in that fashion made them meaningful. I think the challenge that lies before us at this moment is to get governments to adopt and ratify the convention, but equally it is to mobilize the international human rights community to take seriously the provisions of the convention and to engage in the kind of monitoring which will bring about the embarrassment of governments, and in that fashion make meaningful the provisions, whether or not they are subject to enforcement, to litigation, because the strongest pressure that can be mobilized on behalf of human rights anywhere in the world is the force of public pressure. Thank you very much.
We have a few minutes left in our break for lunch here, and REA and Herman have agreed to stay on for a little bit. So we can open it up for some questions and discussion. There are people with microphones. Adar. Okay. Jerry. I think there's a Aaron. Has a microphone and is walking up. If people could generally identify themselves before they speak, that would be helpful.
Hello. Gary White, the Executive Director of Landmine Survivors Network. Ari, thank you very much for, again, your leadership and intelligence supplied to this very important issue. In our previous conversations and also in our experience at Landmine Survivors Network, we went around to the large human rights institutions. We did the tour, and we were realizing that we had to lobby our allies, our friends, those who were leaders in human rights, from Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, MacArthur, Ford foundations, who had traditionally been active in human rights. And the answer we got very often was, well, we don't do disability rights. They're special rights. So what moved, we moved from that position to work with disability organizations around the world and create this convention, thinking that if there is actually an international standard and tool and legal obligation, that perhaps some of these establishment human rights movements, organizations, would then pay greater attention. Now we're at that moment where things can be incorporated. Do you have ideas for strategies? In fact, there's still some resistance we're hearing from different movements and groups saying, well, you know, if we had resources, but the balkanization of life, so to speak, or this idea that they could be bought or promoted in that way is still rather disturbing to many of us in the disability rights community. I'm wondering if you have a long history here, you might have some advice for us, like how to infiltrate, integrate mainstream, and make this about not just 650 million people in the world, but 6 billion.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of or a few comments on that. One comment is that I think that it's important to define disability rights in a certain way. And an example of the way I think it can be defined, and I think it should be defined, is as is done in the Equality Act in South Africa. The Equality Act in South Africa deals with discrimination on grounds of race, gender, and disabilities, and it puts the three on the same plane. And I think that's very important because, the rights of the disabled are rights of persons who have the status of being disabled, as the rights of racial minorities are the rights of persons who have the status of being members of a racial minority, and as the rights of women are the rights of persons who have the status of being women. And I think that approach to the rights of the disabled, I think, gives the concept a significance, which is one which it deserves. But I think that can be important in the way in which rights organizations think about it. I also think that the UN Convention is an enormous help because, as I said, the major mechanism that most rights groups use is monitoring. And so it gives them something to monitor. It allows them to say, here are normative standards. They have been adopted. They have been agreed to. Our government has said that it will abide by these standards. And so this is the sort of work they ordinarily do. And therefore, doing it in this context, I think, is appropriate. The question of resources is not one which you can it's not a trivial one, and there are difficulties. Now, let me illustrate this with my own experience at Human Rights Watch. In the late 1980s, we had decided that, members of the Human Rights Watch board and I had decided that we wanted to establish a women's rights project. We got tremendous resistance to the idea. At that point, it was not generally accepted that women's rights was part of the mandate of human rights organizations. The largest funder through most of our history up to that point had been the Ford Foundation. At that point, the MacArthur Foundation had just come in and had exceeded the Ford Foundation. But the Ford Foundation was still our second largest donor at that moment. The Ford Foundation human rights officer was somebody who came out of Amnesty International in the 1960s and believed that the human rights agenda, as defined by Amnesty in the 1960s, was the proper human rights agenda. And that didn't embrace women's rights. And so she was immensely antagonistic, and her immediate superior was immensely antagonistic, to the point where they cut the Ford Foundation's funding for Human Rights Watch. Within the staff, we had tremendous resistance. The woman who directed our Asia division also came out of Amnesty International and was appalled at the idea that we would engage in efforts on behalf of women's rights. And there were others on the staff who took similar positions. So we had a loss of funding for getting into the field. We had staff resistance, and we had a huge agenda to deal with. It would be very easy not to deal with the issue of women's rights. Well, a few years later, it was broadly accepted that human rights organizations dealt with women's rights, but our willingness to go into the field played a significant part in that shift in the agenda. So when organizations say to you, you know, it's not easy. In fact, it isn't easy for them. They don't necessarily have in their own circle people who are experts in the field. They do want to bring somebody on if they're going to do it who has the expertise. They need the resources for that. There is resistance from the people who are engaged in the present activities of the institution. So there are hurdles to overcome. They can be overcome. And the convention helps enormously in that respect. I mean, frankly, the fact that the Open Society Institute is a source of funding could also be a help. We have a board meeting coming up in 2 weeks, and we have an agenda item to enlarge the funding that is available because of the convention in order to be able to support the ratification efforts. If we have money available for it, it'll be easier for various groups to get involved. But those the sort of practical realities are something one has to deal with.
Judy? Is there a microphone for Judy there?
Some countries which, like the United States and Eastern Europe and Europe, have created large institutions over the years where we're looking at the issue of deinstitutionalization. But in many other countries where at this moment there are very few institutions, but as economies get stronger...
Judy, could you speak a little closer into the microphone? There are some people who are signaling to me that they can't hear.
But in those countries...
It's not working at all? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I think it's working to some degree.
The point that I'm trying to make is that I think the issue of standards is very important, and the creation of standards in countries that do have institutions and don't have institutions I think is equally important. And that the challenge that we're looking at around the world are some countries, more affluent countries, who created institutions, but we're now looking at the issue of taking them apart, and other countries that have not yet created institutions. And I was just wondering, is there any work that you're doing right now that would also be providing assistance to countries that have not yet embraced the issue of institutionalization to really ward off the creation of institutions?
Yeah. Up to now, our efforts in the mental disability rights field has focused not exclusively, but mainly, and a stronger word than mainly is probably required, on the countries of the former Soviet bloc. And those are countries which have had institutions. We're looking to engage on these issues on a more global basis, and the challenges will be very different in other parts of the world. Years ago, I undertook an investigation of prisons in India, and I was startled or shocked to learn at the time that a lot of the places where the mentally disabled were confined in India were simply wings of the various jails and prisons around the country. They weren't different in any aspect of their operation. They were simply other parts of the same institution. So there are going to be many variations from country to country, and I think we'll have to learn by taking on a responsibility for this effort more globally about the different circumstances in different countries and how to try to deal with those circumstances.
Okay. Rob, in the front.
Thanks. Rob Cushing from the Open Society Institute. All right. One of the questions that I've had about the convention is that while to some extent the convention recapitulates existing standards that arguably exist in other international instruments, in a few areas the convention appears to be really pushing the envelope. We heard a speaker earlier talk about the area of supported decision making and the fact that there are very few countries where a robust model of supported decision making exists, and yet the convention in its provisions on legal capacity suggests that that's where countries should be. And so my question is, do you have experience of human rights standards that really are far in advance of state practice, and how can civil society help to monitor and press those standards that seem to go well beyond what most states are doing in terms of them?
It's a good question. I'm not sure that I have the ready example to mind of standards that go significantly beyond state practice. I do think that question of legal capacity and supported legal capacity is really one of the outstanding features of this convention. Thinking about other international standards, it's very hard to think of things in most international human rights treaties which really are as revolutionary as that. If you look at for instance the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, there are things that are, let's say, different from what is the practice under, say, the Bill of Rights in the United States. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, for instance, includes a provision involving compensation for those who are accused of crime and then acquitted. And we don't have a right of that sort, let's say, in the United States. I don't think there has been enough of a push to deal with something like that in the work under the International Covenant. So I don't think that's an issue quite as central as this question of legal capacity. The legal capacity provision is you know, it seems to me at the very core of this convention.
Herman, you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, Arye, what role do you see for the committee that will either immediately, I don't really know how that works, or ultimately set up to enforce the convention, like the Committee on Civil and Political Rights under the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights and others?
These committees can be important, but only to the degree that there is a significant effort by civil society groups internationally to make its activities significant. That is, the filing of shadow reports, monitoring reports, giving it the basis for being able to evaluate the reports that it gets from government and treating its decisions seriously, seems to me at least as important as the actual work that the committee itself does.
Okay. Any other last questions? Holly.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Aria, just marvelous. The last conversation about the legal autonomy and rights in the convention informs my question about where the opposition to the U.S. Signature and ratification will come. Someone earlier today said something about who would want to be opposed, and I think that there are some real advantages. The issue is so dynamic, and the community is so dynamic. On the issue, but when I think back to our inability to achieve U.S. signing of the mine ban convention, it really turned not on the absence of dynamic civil society. There were lots of people, Jerry White's here, many other people in the room were active on the effort, but it sort of turned on expertise. And when there's a head-to-head between Jerry Williams and the ICBL and the Pentagon, most policymakers are going to go with a question of expertise in the Pentagon. I have been trying to think through where we're going to get into trouble. On this convention, I'm finding myself a little nervous about the medical community, about the hospitals, and about family members of institutionalized persons as being a source of alternative expertise to that that you see represented in this room. And I'm wondering what you're thinking.
I mean, I'm sure that provision on legal capacity will be the greatest stumbling block so far as the United States is concerned. And I think the argument will be that guardianship decisions are a state responsibility, and that the federal government is not in a position to sign a treaty that would override the various state laws on that subject, that it's traditionally an issue that is left to the states. And I think that will it's hard for me to see the U.S. Ratifying the treaty, given the opposition that there will be on that particular issue. Now, I don't know. I mean, the treaty says that reservations can't be inconsistent with the treaty. Is that something that could be dealt with through a reservation? I don't know. I think that would be inconsistent with the treaty.
You're not going to get me to go there.
Okay.
We had one question from the very back. Can we get a microphone right? Oh.
Potential opponents, nursing homes, which after all are being emptied out by people's votes with their feet, but which rely enormously upon orphans' courts and guardianships and the sale of property and declarations of incompetence. I hope they don't wake up too soon.
Okay, I think we may have time for one last question, so you can be able to get a little break before we continue at 2:30. Any last questions for Ari and Iyer while we have them here? If not, well, thank you very, very much. That was extremely valuable background. Really appreciate it. And at your next board meeting, we'll all be rooting for you. Thanks very much.